Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. My first guest today spent 20 years interviewing presidents, Oscar winners, astronauts, and Olympians. She's covered murder trials, wildfires, and delved into human interest stories. But what does it take for a journalist who's used to reporting objective facts to open up and share her very own personal journey? Well, we'll find out in just a moment when four-time Emmy Award winner Hattie Kaufman joins me in just a moment. Later, we'll explore how to tap into your intuitive self using freeform streams of drawing. No, you don't have to be able to draw. You just have to be open to letting things flow. And artist, Reiki master, and intuitive reader Elaine Clayton joins me around 12:35 today. But first, let me properly introduce my first guest. During her almost 22 years as a national correspondent with CBS News, Hattie Kaufman reported for CBS This Morning, The Early Show, CBS Evening News with Katie Couric, and before that with Dan Rather, 48 Hours, CBS Special Events, and the list goes on. She earned four Emmys, as I said, during that time. And for those of us here in Seattle, you might remember that Hattie's television career began right here in Seattle on NBC affiliate King 5 News. Hattie Kaufman, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And I was such a baby then when I was working at King.
Well, you had quite an honor because you were a baby, for one, as you said. So you were very young, but you were also the first Native American reporter, as I understand it, on air. Is that correct?
At that time, no, not at King. There was somebody here in Seattle named Tana Beebe who worked for Cairo way back when I was a child, and she was Native American. I happened to encounter her one day downtown Seattle doing a stand-up, and it, you know, stand-up meaning she's talking to the camera with her microphone in her hand, and I thought, wow, she's doing that. I could do that too. So Tana Beebe really was a trailblazer here in Seattle. I became the first Native American to report on the network, and that happened, you know, later in the 80s.
Okay. So tell me why you wanted to become a journalist and why on television?
Well, it really started when I was in college. I was at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis in the 1970s, and I'm American Indian. Now, think about what was going on in the 1970s. The American Indian Movement, and they were headquartered right there in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And so as a young college student, I just got the opportunity because the university station said, hey, there's a lot of American Indian news happening. We should send one of our American Indian students out to interview these people like Dennis Banks, Russell Means, Clyde Belcourt, the leaders of the American Indian Movement. And I happened to be the one student who raised her hand and said, I'll do it. You know, I really didn't know anything about journalism, but it started because I was right there in the headquarters of it happening.
Isn't that, when you just have to take that opportunity sometime. If you had not raised your hand,
yes,
things could have been totally different.
Totally different. And I actually share that story when I talk to young American Indians graduating from high school or college. For instance, I'm making a commencement speech later this week at a tribal college in North Dakota, to encourage people to raise your hand, to volunteer, to open that door, because you don't know how many other doors are behind that one.
Right. Well, you've reported some amazing stories. Do you have a favorite? People ask me, who's the favorite person you've interviewed? What's the favorite person you've shared? And I can't tell them one.
Yeah, because there are so many and they're so varied. But a couple stick in mind. One was when I talked to Betty Ford. She, as you know, had been quite courageous in sharing that she had breast cancer before people even talked about it. They just said the C word cancer, mm-hmm. Somebody whispered.
Right.
Nobody ever had the details. And she shared the details. And then she was brave enough to talk about addiction. And so when I talked to her and sat down across from her, there I was, the journalist, with the focus on you. It's all about you. It's not about me. Who knew that at the time I might in the future share my own story, you know, recovery and cancer as well.
Right. Well, that's a good segue because I wanted to ask you at some point, and we might as well do that now, you know, how difficult was it for you to turn that around and put the spotlight on yourself? You were raised what I call old school journalism. You reported objectively. You did not editorialize, as we often see happening today.
Mm-hmm.
This book is a memoir, Falling Into Place, a memoir of overcoming. And you've been extremely open. You've shared some terrible hurts and pains in there, stories of your childhood, which was very difficult by normal standards, and your journey to Christianity. How difficult was it for you to open up?
All of that, because it goes against what I learned as an old school journalist, that it's not about me and that I have to be a blank slate. How can we be objective if we come into any right. situation with our own goals or agenda? For instance, when I started here at King in the 80s, there was the American Indian Fishing Rights War going on. We just buried Billy Frank yesterday. There was that big funeral for this American Indian fishing rights leader. Well, I was working in the 80s here covering those stories, and I had to not be an American Indian, you know, thinking about fishing rights when I'm out interviewing both sides on that story. So I learned how to be kind of invisible. And then to do my book now, to really reveal, if it is a memoir of overcoming, I have to share what I've overcome. And you mentioned the childhood. When I was working here and I was in my 20s at King, it dawned on me that the fact that we were seven kids left alone often, and we were sometimes without food and without electricity, without heat, without water, that would be a story today. If you if we encountered seven kids in a home, we would be doing a live shot, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
And say, you know, Child Protective Service has been called, and I'm standing right in front, and you can see the kids come. You know, it would be a story. And yet I was in my 20s when it dawned on me, wow, there's a story that was untold, and what do I do with that? And what I learned as a young reporter is you stuff it and you don't talk about it. And maybe now that I am retired from CBS, I'm able to talk about it. But it wasn't easy.
Yeah, you do talk very openly about many, many things. And I wanted to start talking about the book, Falling Into Place, A Memoir of Overcoming. I wanted to start with the beginning of your divorce, the end of your marriage, because I was sitting there reading that and my mouth fell open at some of the things that this man you were married to and you loved and you thought you were happy with and you thought he was happy. Some of the things he was saying to you were just, they were cruel. There's no other word for it. But you go home one day, you're in a 17-year stable marriage. You go home one day and what happens?
He says, I'm no longer committed to this marriage. I've never been committed to this marriage. In fact, I just settled for you. And those are the kind of words that knock you off your chair. I really felt like the ground suddenly wasn't stable under my feet. It's almost like, whoa, you know, the whole world is shaking.
Right.
And that made me look at all that I had built my life on. You know, when you come out of that kind of childhood of chaos, which I did, which comes from being in an alcoholic home, nothing makes sense. There's no solidity. So the fact that it felt like the ground was like I'm standing on a waterbed, it's shaking so much, that was familiar. And I realized it was the feeling I'd had as a 4-year-old or 5-year-old or 6-year-old child wondering what's going to happen next, what's going to happen next. So in my head, even though I'm 52 years old and have a successful career, when my husband says these terrible words to me, it feels like I'm a little child again. It scared me at a visceral, primal level.
Right. And it didn't really sink in, did it? And I think this is true of many of us, myself included. You know, I've been through a divorce. But when people go, when you think one thing is one way and you find out it's another, it's a very surreal situation for quite a little time.
For a little while, I think you're in shock.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember it was sort of like I felt stunned, like I got clubbed on the head or something, where I would be. I remember being in traffic at a red light and just kind of looking and seeing a water fountain and staring, there's a water fountain. I mean, it was almost like I was dull in the head for days or weeks because I couldn't grasp what was happening.
Right. And you actually were on you went up to an interview the following day up
to
Santa Barbara.
The very next day, can you believe it? I was sent out to interview somebody and I was just like, just kind of the walking dead.
But there was a little significance there, even though you may not have recognized it at the time, because the person you were interviewing talked about God. Tell us what she was talking about, why that was significant, became significant later on.
Okay, well, we were sent out to do a story about successful home businesses. I was working for CBS, the morning program at the time, and they would often do a series about something or another. So we were doing successful home businesses. I drove up to interview this woman who had started a business of selling, I think on the internet, items that she imported from Africa that were made by African women. She was African American. And she said that God woke her up with this idea one day that she must sell items made by women in Africa. And in the middle of our interview, she says this, and I think, oh my gosh, here I am. I'm going through a terrible time. I've just driven 3 hours to sit down and interview this person. I'm having a terrible day. And now she's telling me God woke her up. And to me, I was like, you are a nut. And why am I here? And yet her words, and she was very adamant about it. And she would repeat it. And I think she might have seen that my eyes were wandering or something, but she looked right at me and repeated it. God woke me up. I could not ignore God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll talk more about that later on. So you, there's a line in the book that I liked. You said you were looking around your kitchen the morning after your husband's revelation, if you will, that he didn't want to be there anymore. And you said the kitchen belonged to the woman I was yesterday. The instincts born of habit felt foreign and irrelevant. And we've talked about how that is so surreal. So how did you get through those next few weeks?
Boy, I think from a long life of putting one foot in front of the other, you know, that childhood that I described, we do come out of there with some gifts despite all of that hardship. And one of the gifts is we're good in a crisis and we can keep going. And I just kept going, even though, as I said, I felt a little brain dead. But eventually I got it. I mean, there's a funny scene in the book when I finally talked to a divorce lawyer who says, don't sign anything. You're in shock. And she calls me sweetheart, or she's somehow nice. And her little niceness, I say, where do I sign? Where do I sign?
Isn't that the truth,
yes,
though? You can kind of fake it, but as soon as somebody's really nice to you.
Kind, yes, it just broke everything in me. Just somebody be nice.
Well, we need to take a quick break. And my guest today is Hattie Kaufman, and her book is called Falling Into Place, A Memoir of Overcoming. And when we come back, I have some more questions around, mainly why you didn't kick that dude out of that house. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Let's see if I guess that this just isn't working.
Knowing you have a great idea for a book is one thing, writing it another. So what's stopping you? Maybe you can't find time. Maybe you don't know where to begin. Maybe you wrote a couple of chapters, then disappeared down a rabbit hole. Or maybe you'd rather someone else write it for you. Partnering with the right coach or ghostwriter can make all the difference between talking about your book and finishing your book. As an award-winning writer and strategic consultant, Vicki St. Clair's storytelling credits span from business, health, self-help, and memoir to New York Times and USA Today best-selling anthologies. Vicki partners with people just like you, at the exact level you need, whether you need a little encouragement, editorial guidance, or full-blown ghostwriting and consulting services. If you're serious about telling the story you know is inside you, stop procrastinating. Let's get your story down on paper. Contact Vicki today. Email Vicki at VickiSt.Clair.com or call 1-800-495-7617. See more about Vicki and her work at VickiSt.Clair.com.
Oh, yeah, that could work.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
1150kknw.com. It's why they invented the internet. We think Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everybody. I am very pleased to have in the studio with me Hattie Kaufman. She's began her career here in Seattle on King 5 and spent a 22-year career with CBS. And we were just talking about the breakup of a 17-year marriage here, which was a big shocker. You know, many of us have been through similar situations. You chose to live in the house after this revelation. You know, I mean, your husband, as I said some unpleasant things, called you socially awkward. You, socially awkward. I was like, really? but you chose to live together. You didn't kick him out.
I didn't know what to do. And, you know, again, it was as if everything was happening to me. I didn't feel my feet solid under my feet where I could take action and I could do something. I was in the, like you're caught up in the waves or something like that. And that lasted for a number of months, which I describe in my book, in which I tried to be gone a lot. And being a network news correspondent, I could volunteer for stories, raise my hand like I had earlier as a youngster starting out, and accept speeches and accept assignments and sometimes stay on a friend's couch and just to be as absent as I possibly could.
Right. So you were kept busy, and that's a good thing. So let's talk a little bit about your childhood, because you say that you didn't really fit into your family per se. Your cousins saw you as half white, and so you didn't really fit in there maybe as well as you would have liked. We've talked a little bit about some of the challenges you've had. And you and your seven of you all together.
Yes.
You talked about times in the book where your parents would leave you all in the car and then they'd go on a binge into a bar. What from your childhood have you brought into your adult life and how has that made you? One of the things I've heard about you consistently is that you really connect with the people you're interviewing. You really see them as human beings. And I'm guessing that some of that is because of your childhood.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think so. I learned empathy for human beings because I have been through it, whatever it is. And generally, when we're going out to cover a news story, it's covering something tragic. Something bad has happened. And I know what it's like to be on the end of something bad happening. So I think that aspect from my childhood helped me become a better network news correspondent. Also, as a child, I was always asking, how come was my nickname? It's like, how come? How come? And so that's like a perfect thing for a reporter because you are asking who, what, where, why, which really basically is how come this is going on. So I think both of those fueled me. Also, if you've been poor, you never want to go back to being poor. And I came out with a huge work ethic where I would volunteer. I lied when I was 15 and said I was 16 just to get a job. And when I started at King, I learned right away that you have to volunteer to work weekends or nights or Christmas or 4th of July or whenever somebody else isn't there in order to get your chance to be on the air. So I think that helped me. I also, in network news, it is a flying in the seat of your pants kind of life. You don't know where you're going to be sent, when you get to come home. You have to do a crash course in all kinds of issues. You could fly into this or fly into that, and you need to study up on it really quick. You need to be able to ad lib, and you have to, you know, think about all that. Stress. You're live. You got to get it right. You got to look good. You got to sound good. You have to speak with authority. All of that. I mean, it's a high adrenaline kind of life, and I think my childhood was a high adrenaline kind of childhood because we never knew what was going to happen next.
Right.
So I think it was just kind of perfect for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're living in with a certain amount of uncertainty as a kid, and
yes,
definitely in your job, you're constantly living with uncertainty because you never know what's going to break.
Right.
Where you're going to be sent.
Right, which goes back to why this divorce was so unsettling, because I wanted something stable at home. I thought I had built something stable, and then when I found that it was all a house of cards, I'm just thrown for a loop.
Right. So at what point did you decide to leave CBS?
I left CBS. My last paycheck was in 2012. And I think that's significant because earlier when we were talking, and I said I raised my hand as a college student to go cover the American Indian movement, it was 1972. So it was a 40-year career in broadcasting.
That's pretty impressive.
Yes.
Let's talk about staying power. And maybe, again, you're going to credit that to your childhood, because I think most of us can credit a lot to our childhood. But, you know, there's a lot of people who come up very quickly in this business and then disappear. You know, to stick around for 40 some years is a long time in that business.
Right. And I had to reinvent myself over and over again and also prove myself to the new executive producer, because every time there's a new boss coming in, of course, they want to change the look. Their heads will roll. We know that. They change the set. They change the anchors. They change. And every time I had to go in and prove, you can change everything, but you can't change me. You got to keep me and show that I could cover sports, news. I can anchor. I can do, you know, I was always having to prove myself, I guess.
Yeah. So, and this is true of many people in different careers, technology,
yes.
banking, it doesn't matter
sure.
what. Now, you have to stay relevant. And flexibility, obviously, was a very key point
yes,
with you.
Yes. And again, probably back to that childhood in alcoholic home where you're good in a crisis, because covering news is a series of crises. You're always on the scene of a crisis, and how are you going to handle that?
Right. And so you moved back to Seattle. Why Seattle again?
Well, this is where it started. And I was writing my book. Many of those scenes take place right here in Seattle. We were born on the reservation in Idaho, but our family moved here. And so we were seven kids at the housing projects in West Seattle called High Point, and then later on Beacon Hill. So it made sense. And I love this place. I mean, if you were going to choose any major city in America that has a quality of living and has some beauty, it's Seattle.
Oh, it's a beautiful city. We have a beautiful view right now. So why write the memoir? Let's talk about why you decided to write the memoir. Why in memoir form? You know, I was reading Nora Ephron's Heartburn not so long back.
Yes.
That was about her marriage
right.
to Bob Woodward. But of course, they changed all the names and everything in there. But why did you decide to do it as a memoir and not fiction?
I did it as a memoir and not fiction because, number one, I have been a truth teller. I've told stories. I've been writing nonfiction my entire life. I didn't know if I had it in me. Could I write a novel? You know, I didn't even know if I could write my own story because I've written thousands, tens of thousands of stories about other people, but they're little stories. They last 3 minutes at most, 5 minutes maybe, usually just a minute on the air. Could I really write something that's 250 pages minimum? And the only way I could do it was to sit down and just tell. And it wasn't easy to tell.
I'm sure it wasn't. So tell us about, I was going to ask you, you know, what was the high point in writing this for you, and what was the low point? I always think back to a movie with Diane Keaton in when she was dumped by Jack Nicholson. Something's got to give. And she had these high and lows as she's writing about that thing. And I think that's true. I think writing heals in many ways.
Oh, great scene in there was when she would cry.
Yes.
She'd just sit there and just cry.
Yes.
Well, I had some of those experiences as I was at the keyboard and I was typing these scenes from childhood, and sometimes the tears would just be rolling down my face. On the other hand, even though that sounds like a low, that can be a high in that you are so connected. It's not like I'm making it up. I'm so connected with the inner child, the little child. I mean, I had one reviewer or critic say, how did you get into that little childhood voice? And I didn't have a choice. As soon as I started writing, I was right there. I was remembering it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a low, of course, is the fact that I'm pulling back the curtain on this childhood, and I'm not the only child. So how do I deal with my siblings in this, and how do I approach them? Because not everybody may want to have the stories told.
That's very true. So as you're telling your story, do you have any regrets about being so open about anything in the book?
No, I don't, actually. I used to hide these things because I was embarrassed about them, particularly working in television, which can be so glamorous. You know, you're in New York under the bright lights, or you're at the red carpet of the Oscars. And I never wanted to tell about the hunger and the devastation and not even being able to find two shoes that match to go to school. But I know now that telling my story can actually help somebody else, because I am hearing from people all around the country some who relate to the divorce or that, you know, how could I have lived with a lie and not seen it? Others who relate to the fact that they grew up hand to mouth. And, you know, I had a young man I met in Texas last week. He said his mom was a meth addict, and he said he was a bodyguard for his little younger baby brother so that she wouldn't hurt him. I mean, and he bought my book.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, there's a certain connection that's happening that I feel very fulfilled about and humbled by and grateful for.
Yeah, you never know who you're going to touch and in
yes.
what way. But I did read that you read, you partly wrote the book and included so much about your divorce in there because you got such bad divorce advice when you were going through it and nobody knew quite what to say and the advice they gave really didn't work. So what do you hope people will take away from Falling Into Place, Hattie?
I hope that they'll take away a sense that whatever you're going through is not permanent. It's just now. It's not permanent. There is healing and you're never really alone. I thought I was and I wasn't.
Right. And you had a wonderful Aunt Theodora. I feel we have to mention Aunt Theodora. Gift from God is the meaning of her name.
Yes.
You had some kind of estrangement with her, really, because she tried to force or talk to you about Christianity when you were really into your Indian spirituality. Have you found some redemption there? Some
yes.
Peace?
When I was a little girl, she was a real pillar of stability. She would come and she'd check on us, and she taught me the 23rd Psalm. And I had no idea what it meant, but she told me, this is important. You need to memorize these words. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. I didn't know what it meant, but I memorized it at age 7. And there I was at age 52 feeling all alone when I realized Aunt Teddy's words were something I could grab onto.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she is an example in my book of how when you plant seeds, it may take decades before they bear fruit, but they can bear fruit.
Right. And you say faith is to believe and to trust in something or someone. Tell me a little bit more about what it means to you.
Well, I felt, you know, I had rejected Aunt Teddy at age 15, which was, you know, at the same time rejecting God, because she had been trying to teach me about God. And I had this career. I made it. You know, I made it to New York. I made it from that childhood poverty up to the pinnacle of working, you know, at network television. I had this home in Brentwood. I had a team of producers, this long-term marriage. And when that cracked and I saw that everything I had built was on nothing, I realized, is there anywhere I can go? Is there anybody I can trust? And what I found was God.
Mm. So what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, what I came to is pray. That may sound cliche, but give it a try.
Right. And however people interpret that in their own way, whether mm-hmm. it's meditation or prayer and yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, it was in a quieting, just simple quieting moment for me when, you know, when I found my way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for sharing your story with us.
Sure.
I think, you know, being so open and honest, of course, you're going to help other people realize they're not alone in these situations. And the book is called Falling Into Place. It's a memoir of overcoming. And boy, did Hattie Kaufman have to overcome some challenges in her life. But I think the key message I'm going to take away, because I was raised this way, stick your hand in the air and volunteer. And you said that a couple of times
yes.
during our chat here. I think that's a key point for us to remember. You know, when opportunities are there, let's pounce on them.
Yes. Thank you.
Hattie Kaufman, thanks so much. You can find out more about Hattie and her work and her book at HattieKaufman.com, HattieKaufman.com. So please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
This is Meryl Streep. Over the years, I have played some characters you could call controlling, but the truth is, there's so much in life we can't control. But here's something we can: colorectal cancer. It affects men and women, and it's the second leading cancer killer in the U.S., which is astounding, considering it's almost entirely preventable. Here's how. Most colon cancers start as polyps, and screening helps find polyps so they can be removed before they even turn into cancer. Screening also finds this cancer early, when treatment works best. For me, screening was simple and quick. It was no big deal, except for the huge sense of relief you feel afterwards. There are several tests that you can choose from. If you're 50 or older, you should talk to your doctor. Decide which one's right for you. Take control. Do everything you can to prevent colon cancer. Screening saves lives. It could really save your life. For more information, call 1-800-CDC-INFO.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to relationship whisperer Jana Rosewood, we cover the world of animals. This week, May 18th, we'll welcome Lola Michelin, founder and director of the Northwest School of Animal Massage, back to Animal World. With distance learning and schools all over, find out how easy it's gotten to become a massage therapist for animals. Hear all about the classes and events coming up, including lots for those of us who just want to help our own animal friends. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
No shirt, no shoes, no problem. Come as you are. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Whether you're doodling in a notebook or drawing in the sand, freeform drawings can provide windows into our intuitive selves. And my next guest, Elaine Clayton, knows all about this. She's an artist, author, certified Reiki master, intuitive reader, workshop instructor, and creator of Illuminara Intuitive Journal. She's the author and illustrator of several books for children and illustrator of books by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jane Smiley and Wicked author Gregory Maguire, among others. She practices Reiki and intuitive healing in New York City and Connecticut, where she lives with her family. And she's joining us today to talk about her new book. It's called Making Marks: Discover the Art of Intuitive Drawing. Elaine Clayton, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hello. I'm so happy to be here.
And we're pleased to have you here. And we're pleased to learn we're going to learn a little bit about how we can tap into our intuitive selves through the work that you do. I read on your website, my deep wish as I write is for this book to serve the world in a way I intended, to celebrate life, to celebrate you being you and making your mark unique and magnificent. So tell us a little bit. What drove you to put this down on paper?
Well, it's a few things. I think the main thing is I really have a passion for, and I really want to support people in their own self-discovery so that, through drawing and through becoming more conscious, people can make the right choices. And I mean that through my own experiences in life, wanting to empower myself, when I was a lot younger, having to learn how to do that using creative visualization and things. And I really want to be able to share whatever it is I've learned because others shared with me through my, life experiences.
Right.
So it's really about wanting to support others on their journey, I guess, is basically it.
Right. And you say as a child you were constantly drawing, you were constantly going inward, but that going inward had a couple of different meanings for you. Your mother had a near-death experience as you were born, so tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, now that's an interesting thing because, I'm very into near-death experiences anyway. It's one of the most fascinating subjects for me. But yes, my mother, she had a hard time. I was the fifth child, so she already had four other children. And it was an emergency. I think she hemorrhaged and other things. It was very dire. And we lived in a small town in Texas where my dad was one of only a few doctors available. This is out in the panhandle, you know, where it's flat and you
right.
can see forever.
Right.
So there isn't really a lot of help, you know, except for whatever you do have right there. And so other doctors worked on her actually while he saved me. And she remembers going up. She wasn't comfortable. This wasn't a blissful near-death experience. This was because she didn't want to leave us. But she described it as the sensation of floating up above herself and above all the goings-on in the surgery. And she felt terrible because at the same time she could see my brothers and sisters waiting in a car. Some neighbor was taking care of them. And so she kind of had a simultaneous vision of them and what was going on below. And then she decided, you know, she definitely knew she did not want to leave. And so she was saved. She lived.
Right, right.
And she's not comfortable, really, I don't even think, talking about it because it wasn't a great feeling. But it meant a lot to me hearing it, you know,
right.
as I grew up.
Yes, and your grandmother told you that you were born with a veil over your face, which she said meant she would be clairvoyant.
Yeah, well, I think that a lot of people probably would be clairvoyant, and I actually think everyone has the ability, but because I was a C-section, but, you know, it was this, I think it was the way they used to say, if a baby was born with the amniotic sac over its face, it was like a veil.
Right,
and
right.
And so the baby would be able to see between the veil, you know, of this earth and the realm beyond.
Yeah, I've heard that from people in their 90s and older, you know, so I think that's something that used to be very common, you know, a long, long time ago. Your dad was very significant in your perspective as you were growing up. You said he had a big influence on you, in how he helped people heal. You went to him often to talk about dreams and human psyche. Share a little bit about your dad and how he influenced you.
Well, that's very true. I think because we have a good bond, a special one, I think because he saved me at birth, which is unusual for a doctor, because usually you're not the doctor for anyone in your own family, but it was that kind of emergency out in the middle of the panhandle.
Right.
But he's very intuitive. So he, as a doctor, really a healer, he was a DO, an osteopath, and very much, you know, like I have a certificate of his from 1952 where he had learned hypnosis to help women who were in labor so they wouldn't have pain. And that's pretty progressive. You know, that wasn't like something anyone talked about much back then.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember feeling, being made aware of how important compassion was, and also just the fact that when I came to him with a terrible nightmare, the way he handled it, you know, that was just one of the main memories I have. And this had to do with discovering dreams early on and accepting myself and whatever dreams came, and instead of seeing them as all overpowering and something to ignore. You
right,
know, he
right.
taught me to see it in a different way.
Right.
And that really influenced me.
So at what point did you start doing what you call a stream of consciousness drawings? You call them streams. At what point did you start looking at this really seriously?
Well, I think all the drawing that I did as a child, and probably all the drawing everyone does when they're just enjoying themselves and not thinking too hard about it, is a stream of consciousness kind of drawing. And when I started to be aware of it, it was after years of doing intuitive readings and being an artist who draws and dreams. So, you know, visual imagery being a large part of my intuitive sensing. Before a reading one day with a complete stranger, it was a telephone reading actually, I just had the impulse to not only meditate for the person prior to the reading, but to draw. And I thought, this is weird, but it was just an impulse to do.
Right.
And so I kind of stated an intention of wanting to best help the person and just see what would happen. And I closed my eyes, and I actually drew with my left hand. I'm right-handed. And I opened my eyes, and I just thought, I'll just tell her whatever it is I see in the drawing.
Right.
And I think that was the first one. And, you know, later I realized, hey, you know, this is something's happening with this.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you how we can do a stream drawing for ourselves, how we get started, what we need to do that, okay?
Okay, great.
My guest is Elaine Clayton, and her book is called Making Marks, Discover the Art of Intuitive Drawing, and a lot of interesting information in here. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Independent programs, independent voices, independent ideas. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And my guest is Elaine Clayton. She's an artist, Reiki master, author of Making Marks. And we are talking about stream drawing here, stream of consciousness drawing, and how it can help you tap into your intuitive self. And I want to ask you how we can do that for ourselves. But just answer this question first, if you would, Elaine, because you say in the book, there is no such thing as a doodle.
Yeah, I do say that. I'm being kind of a little bit, yeah, I mean, it's, the word doodle is just, okay, there's Yankee Doodle, and I like to sing that song sometimes, but I just felt always, even as a child, that the word doodle sort of put down drawing, you know?
Right.
Someone might do something, and actually realizing that the drawings that people do when they're not, you know, too self-conscious is a wonderful process and this wonderful thing and not something that should have a silly-sounding word. But it may be that it, because they're fun and they're just seen as little nothings, you know, that word got created, I'm not sure. So we don't have to be all so serious, you know, when we sit down to just kind of enjoy drawing. But I do think because something profound happens that it's worth more than the word doodle. And I thought little streamers or stream drawing sounds better.
Right.
It feels better. Feels better.
Right. And when we're in commercial break, you asked me if I ever draw during the radio show, during the interviews. And I don't. But I'm wondering why you asked me that.
Well, because I was sitting here drawing while we were talking.
Oh.
Because I think with one of the great things about drawing that we don't realize necessarily, because it's not like anyone ever talked about it. In fact, if you were caught doodling, you know, drawing in class while the teacher was talking, probably you were in trouble.
Right, right.
So, but actually, there's a lot of people, you know, when they feel nervous or they're listening, and there's even research lately about that, you know, even you may, not only does tension kind of get released, but you may be able to concentrate and listen better because you're focused in on drawing, you know, making these little marks.
Right.
And so it actually increases concentration.
Yeah, I actually read that it increases retention by 29%.
Really? Oh, I love that you knew that.
Yeah,
because I don't really know all the statistics. I'm happy that we're discovering, you know, And that's important, right?
Right, right. So let's talk about when we do our own stream drawing, whether we call it a doodle or making marks or, you know, just scribbling, whatever we call it. You say we need to be more relaxed about it. So what do we do? How do we look at it?
Okay, well, that's mainly the whole idea behind the book, in essence, is how to just get relaxed. Because usually if I ask someone, almost every day someone will say to me, well, I like to draw, but I'm not good at it, so I really don't do it, you know. Or the drawings I do, they're not good, and, you know, I don't really want to show anyone. You know, there's a little bit of loss of pride around it, or, you know, self-criticism. That, you know, when I was teaching young children how to write, and, you know, just like five and six-year-olds, the first thing they do is start to draw, so it's very natural for us to draw, even as we're learning how to write. But there's that inner editor, I guess it's the ego, the part of the ego that wants to put us down all the time. So the first thing we have to do is just realize it really isn't about good or bad. That drawing isn't only about making something look realistic. Drawing also has this whole other beautiful component, which is it's a process where you get to feel what it's like to have, you know, the pencil or the marker make tension on the paper and then a little less tension and more tension. You know, in other words, feeling your way through using an implement, you know, to express yourself.
Right.
So how do you get to that? You know, if you criticize yourself, you can't even get started, really. It's
right.
Very hard to get started.
That's true of so many things, yeah.
Yes, it is, isn't it? And so I felt like the first way to do this is to realize we're just playing. You know, some of the best things in the world happen when we're in a playful, easy, relaxed place. Problems get solved. Sometimes ideas surface, you know, a sense of discovery and wonderment. And you can get into that so easily. You don't have to do anything. All you have to do is just say, I'm going to draw and I'm going to let myself draw. And I think one of the best ways in the book kind of has several steps that you take, and they're not complicated at all, but, you know, it's good to try a few things to get to that relaxed place.
Right.
But the most simple way is like I said, when I did the first intuitive stream drawing for a reading, I just instinctively wanted to not have to edit or control myself. I just wanted feelings to come through or something. And so I closed my eyes. That was big, right? Because then you're not looking at what you're drawing to criticize it. And then I used my non-dominant hand, because we are so taught to be in control, you know, and to make marks that make sense and all that.
Right,
that
right.
You want to use the other hand that doesn't really have that control. And wow, you know, some kids, when we do some of these exercises, they've said to me that it feels like flying.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
So close your eyes and draw, maybe listen to some music, and don't even look at the drawing. And the book shows some of the ways to get there.
And you talk about in the book, too, you just mentioned children. So I want to just say that you do talk about using this in the home, this with your children. And there are a couple of ways that you can encourage your kids, and one I liked was the dream dragon.
Oh, and that wasn't my idea. That was an idea that was such a great idea. At the school where I taught in Boston, the Atrium School, the progressive independent elementary school, and I think the founder, Jenny Kahn, she's a psychologist, she knew that kids have dreams. So instead of pretending that we don't have them and sometimes are disturbed by them, there was a dream dragon made out of, it was like a box, like paper mache or something in the hallway, and you could come in, and I did it a few times myself because I had such heavy dreams. But the kids knew that they could come in and they could draw or write about their dream, and without really having to ask for permission or to get you know, anyone else involved in what the dream was, in case they didn't want to tell anyone, they could just go put it in the dream dragon's mouth. And it was so wonderful and so loving, you know, accepting of the works of the unconscious mind and natural part of our processing, that I thought it was brilliant. And so I think, wouldn't that be great if everyone had one
right,
at home?
Right. And so when we start our streams and we start drawing, making our marks, how do we begin to unravel what they mean? Because you know as well as I do and everyone else that, you know, 100 people could look at a picture of something and take away 100 different interpretations.
Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. Same thing with a dream. A dream is multidimensional in what it offers. You can do Jungian, you can do Freud, you can say, what does it mean to me? What did I feel during the dream? What did I eat? How's my body? You know, how's my health? Et cetera, et cetera. They never stop offering ways to look at them. The same thing with the drawing. And with this book, really, there it's a two-part thing, I think. One is to, first of all, just be loose and happy enough to allow yourself to draw something so natural to us that should never have been taken away or discouraged in any way. And the other is to reflect upon what you drew to see if it has meaning in it for you. So it isn't like there's a right or wrong there either.
Right.
Absolutely. And it isn't, my idea here isn't to analyze someone or to judge someone or myself. It's more about sharing what something means to me and see if sharing that with you helps you at all.
Right. Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, Elaine, but I want to ask this because I am a doodler. I remember being chastised in business meetings, you know, 20 years ago because you're not paying attention. But as science now tells us, I was actually retaining 29% more than everyone else because I was avidly doodling.
Yeah, and you might
doodling.
Have been coming up with the next best thing and they missed out on it. What a foolish thing. Oh, my gosh, yeah.
But what I've noticed is that when I doodle on paper, my doodles, let's say I'm in a meeting, my doodles would tend to be very angular. And if I'm doodling, say, in the sand, making marks in the sand, those might be totally different. They might be big swirls and very circular, very fluid movements. So does the medium that we're using have significance in our drawing?
Oh, I think so. And also where you are and what state you're in. I mean, at a business meeting, it might be a lot of angles too, right? I mean, you know,
right?
But I would say to you, next time you draw, feel what you're feeling and sense it and try to put words to it and trust what your perception is of that emotion at the time. You know, like, because really, I was thinking of this before we talked, that if you're nervous in your drawing, they look very different from when you're relaxed. You know, there might be a bunch of check marks or I don't know. The quality of the line and the shape of things does reveal and does give us impressions, but the main and only impression that matters is your own, about your own drawing, really.
Okay.
You could ask someone, what feeling do you get when you look at this, and you might get a lot out of me sharing what I see, like, hey, that feels like I'm in a maze because I'm going here, then I'm over there, and I feel like I'm in the army, or, you know, the swirly, I feel like I'm loving life right now, you know. But it may or may not. It may mean something totally different for you personally, and I would really trust that.
Okay. Well, that all sounds very interesting and certainly worth exploring. And the book is called Making Marks, Discover the Art of Intuitive Drawing. My guest, of course, Elaine Clayton. Elaine, thanks so much for being with us today and sharing your knowledge of this with us.
Thank you so much, and I'd love for you to send me some of your little streamers. I'd love to see them and share, you know.
I just might do that.
Okay. Thank you again.
Yeah, my pleasure. You can find out more about Elaine at Illuminara.com, Illuminara.com. And she's got a blog up there, and she talks a little bit more about how she interprets other people's streams, because she is an intuitive reader. It's very interesting. She's an artist, Reiki master, and author of Making Marks, The Art of Intuitive Drawing. And I want to thank you for being with us today. Always appreciate you tuning in and spending this hour with us. We will be back next week. If you have questions or comments on today's show, if you missed anything and or would like more information, you can find me at info@conversationslive.net, info@conversationslive.net, and that's plural, conversations is plural. Or you can find me at 800-495-7617. 800-495-7617. Of course, our website is conversationslive.net, and you can find my personal website at vickysaintclair.com. You can find us on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair. And I would love for you to follow us, join us on Facebook. Tell us about your business. Tell us about your projects. Tell us what you're working on. Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair on Facebook. Thanks for being with us. Until next week, live well, live strong.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.